Okay, here's something to think about. Have you ever really considered that the way you save, and maybe even more importantly, how you spend your money, could actually be shaping the future you live in? I mean, beyond just building your own personal wealth, what if those financial decisions could actively, build the world you believe in?
That's a really profound question, and it's exactly what we're diving into today. We're going to unpack this powerful idea, unspent capital versus spent capital, specifically looking at it through the lens of Bitcoin.
Right, unspent versus spent capital. It's a fascinating framework. So our mission today really is to guide you, our listener, through what we're calling the complete Bitcoin journey.
Yeah, the whole path.
Exactly. We want to explore how you can go from just, getting some exposure to Bitcoin, maybe through an ETF or something, all the way to becoming a true owner, holding your own keys, and even being an active contributor.
And showing how Bitcoin is really seen by many as the ultimate unspent capital, that secure, kind of future-proof savings.
And then how everything else becomes spent capital, money you deploy deliberately, maybe even to strengthen those Bitcoin savings and influence the world around you.
So let's break that down. At its core, unspent capital is savings. But in this specific philosophy we're exploring, it's Bitcoin.
Right.
It's viewed as, well, fundamentally secure, sure, and future-proof. Its main job. To hold and hopefully grow your purchasing power over time.
Right, the store of value argument.
Exactly. And crucially, it represents the default place for your capital. And maybe more significantly, it represents the opportunity cost of everything you spend.
Ah, okay. So if that's unspent capital, basically Bitcoin in this model, then everything else, literally everything else, falls into spent capital.
That's the idea. Your daily coffee, your rent or mortgage, buying stuff, investing in, say, stocks or bonds, even donating to causes you care about.
All spent capital. It's the capital you're actively putting to work, hopefully building the future you want to see.
And this is where that mindset shift really clicks in, or at least starts to. Every single time you choose to spend, there's an implicit opportunity cost.
Because that money could have stayed as unspent capital.
Right. Safe, secure, potentially appreciating in value within the Bitcoin network. Now, this doesn't mean you just stop spending entirely. That's obviously not realistic.
Yeah, you need to live.
Of course. It just means you start becoming, let's say, more discerning, more intentional about how and why you spend.
That's a really powerful reframe. Okay, so why Bitcoin? Why is it positioned as this ideal unspent capital? What makes it so different from, say, just saving dollars or gold?
Well, it boils down to some really unique characteristics. First, and maybe most famously, its supply. It's absolutely fixed, immutable, capped at 21 million BTC units.
Which is unlike pretty much any other currency or asset we know.
Precisely. Unlike fiat currencies governments can print more of, or even company shares where companies can issue more stock, Bitcoin's fixed supply means it can't be diluted over time. That's fundamental for something acting as long-term unspent capital, preserving purchasing power.
Okay, fixed supply. Then there's proof of work. People talk about it a lot, often related to energy use. But why is it so vital for this idea of secure unspent capital?
Proof of work is, well, it's the engine of security. You have these specialized computers, miners, expending real-world energy to solve complex mathematical problems.
Right, solving the puzzles.
Yeah, and by doing that, they validate transactions and add new blocks to the blockchain. This proof is verifiable by anyone, and it makes it incredibly, incredibly expensive and difficult for any attacker to try and cheat the system or change past transactions.
So it's tied to real-world cost.
Exactly. That verifiable cost, that expenditure of real energy, not just someone clicking a button to create more money, is what guarantees Bitcoin scarcity and makes its security so robust. It ensures it's truly future-proof savings that, can't just be counterfeited or inflated away by decree.
And that security ties directly into its decentralized nature, doesn't it? This idea that no single company, no government controls it, making it censorship resistant, almost like free speech money. How important is that decentralization for unspent capital?
It's absolutely critical because no single entity controls Bitcoin. Your access to your unspent capital doesn't depend on a bank's permission or a government allowing you
They
access.
can't just freeze your account.
Exactly. It becomes fundamentally censorship resistant. In that sense, it's like free speech money. You have the ultimate sovereignty over your own financial resources, free from external pressures or controls. That's vital if you're thinking about long-term secure savings.
You made a point earlier about the 21 million BTC being units, not the whole thing. Could you elaborate on that one Bitcoin concept? How does that reframe its scarcity?
Yeah, it's a subtle but important distinction. We often hear 21 million Bitcoin, but that number, BTC, refers to the units of account, like dollars or euros.
Your hectares for land.
A perfect analogy. There's only one Bitcoin, the network, the protocol, the shared decentralized ledger itself. It's the whole system. It's fixed code base. And that genuinely fixed supply protects it from dilution.
Unlike fiat.
Right.
Or even shares.
Right. And crucially, it's the global network of individuals running their own Bitcoin nodes, their own copies of the ledger, who enforce these rules by consensus. They collectively guarantee its scarcity and integrity. No central authority needed.
Okay. That paints a clearer picture. So if Bitcoin represents this new kind of unspent capital, a secure anchor for future wealth, it really shifts how we view traditional money, doesn't it? What about the cash in our bank accounts? Is that savings in this model?
Well, according to this philosophy, no. Not really. When you put money in a bank, you're technically not a saver in the sense of holding a direct asset. You become a creditor.
You're lending them money.
You are. You're lending your money to the bank, and they turn around and use it for their own purposes, making loans, investing, whatever their business model dictates. And here's the catch.
Inflation.
Inflation. If the interest rate they pay you is less than the actual rate of inflation, your purchasing power, your wealth is actively eroding over time. That's not really saving. It's a slow leak.
So fiat money, dollars, euros, whatever, it's more like a temporary cash.
Yeah.
A holding spot before it gets used.
Exactly. That's a great way to put it. Think of like your web browser caching images. It doesn't store them forever, just temporarily, because they'll likely be needed soon.
Or like a chef prepping vegetables before dinner service.
Perfect. They're prepped, they're cached, ready to go, but they're not meant to live in that prep bowl forever.
Yeah, I definitely have that little pile of foreign coins from a trip years ago sitting in a drawer. Totally useless now, but I never cleared the cache.
Exactly. It highlights how that value can just sit there and spoil, essentially. So the idea is fiat should be cleared out relatively frequently. Holding it long term means it's likely losing value.
And even for that temporary holding, how we store fiat makes a difference, right?
Absolutely. You've got central bank paper cash, physical notes and coins. You hold it yourself, it's private. But downside, it's vulnerable to theft, a pain for large amounts, and it erodes fastest from inflation because it earns zero interest.
Okay. Then there's the bank account money.
Right. Commercial bank digital credits. That's the number you see on your banking app. Super convenient, yes. But remember, it's technically an IOU from the bank, a loan you've given them, carrying counterparty risk, however small you might think it is.
And less private.
Much less private. It's heavily surveilled. Your payment history might be analyzed, maybe even sold to advertisers or shared with government agencies.
So what's the potential future for fiat in this kind of Bitcoin-centric model? Does it just disappear?
Not necessarily. It could evolve. You could see something like digital paper cash emerge, still fiat, but maybe self-custodied using technology, private, fully backed perhaps, and potentially even compatible with newer payment tech built on Bitcoin.
Like Lightning.
Exactly. Like the Lightning Network, for instance, cheap payments, or maybe protocols like eCash focused on privacy for smaller amounts. So fiat could still play a useful, albeit temporary, role as a medium of exchange, even if Bitcoin becomes the primary store of value, the unspent capital.
That makes sense. Okay, let's shift gears to the practical side of the Bitcoin journey. How does someone actually start down this path towards sovereignty? Step one you mentioned is back Bitcoin. What does that look like?
Right. Step one, back Bitcoin. This is really the simplest entry point. The goal is just to get some financial exposure to Bitcoin's price performance.
Get some skin in the game.
Get skin in the game, exactly. And importantly, it gives you that incentive to actually learn more about it. The main ways to do this are through regulated Bitcoin ETFs, exchange-traded funds that you can buy right in your normal brokerage account.
Like buying a stock.
Pretty much. Or including Bitcoin in a retirement portfolio if that option's available. A really common strategy here is dollar cost averaging, DCA.
Just buying a little bit regularly.
Yeah. Investing a fixed amount, say $50 or $100 every week or month, no matter what the price is doing. It smooths out the volatility and helps you build a position over time without trying to guess the market tops and bottoms.
So you're saying you don't immediately need to figure out private keys and wallets and all that tech stuff. this stage.
Not at all. That comes later. Bitcoin ETFs track the price. They're listed on familiar stock exchanges. So, you know, if you're in New Zealand, maybe you look at the Smart Shares Bitcoin ETF via Sharesies. In the US, you've got big players now like Fidelity's FBTC or BlackRock's IBT.
Yeah.
This first step is about signaling your belief in Bitcoin's potential, getting comfortable with how its price moves because it is volatile, and building that natural curiosity to learn more about self-custody as your holding grows.
All right, step one, get some exposure. Makes sense. Then, once you have that skin in the game, the next step in the journey is step two, stack sats. You mentioned sats. Maybe just quickly remind us what those are.
Right, sats, satoshis. They're simply the smallest unit of Bitcoin. Think of them like cents to a dollar or pennies to a pound. There are 100 million sats in one whole Bitcoin.
Got it. So stacking sats means accumulating these small units. How do you actually do that?
Well, the best way to really understand Bitcoin is to start using it. And the easiest way to use small amounts for everyday things is often via the Lightning Network.
Which is like a layer on top of Bitcoin for faster, cheaper payments.
Exactly. So you start by downloading a Lightning wallet onto your phone or computer. And honestly, at this stage, whether it's custodial, meaning someone else holds the keys for you, simpler to start, or non-custodial, where you hold the keys, it doesn't matter too much just for trying it out.
Okay, any examples of easy wallets to start with?
Sure. For simple mobile use, something like Blink is popular. There's Wallet of Satoshi, often recommended for beginners. Or for a web-based option, Coinos is quite powerful, supporting Lightning, Liquid, eCash, other Bitcoin layers too.
And then you need a way to receive sats.
Yeah, you'll typically get a Lightning address. This is super useful. It looks just like an email address, like you at getlb.com or something similar, but it's for receiving Bitcoin instantly over Lightning. Much easier than sharing those long, complex Bitcoin addresses for small payments.
Okay, so get a wallet, get an address. Then what? How do you actually stack them?
You can start earning them, maybe through online tips if you create content, doing small online tasks or bounties. You can use them to buy digital goods or services. Explore platforms like Nostr, that's a decentralized social network where people often tip each other or zap each other, small amounts of sats directly.
Zapping, heard that term.
Yeah, it's basically sending a small Lightning payment, often attached to a social media post or reaction. It's really about starting to feel how Bitcoin works in practice value, moving almost instantly anywhere in the world for tiny fees. It's your on-ramp to actually participating in the Bitcoin economy.
Okay, that makes sense. Get exposure, then start using it with Lightning. Now, once you've stacked a meaningful amount of sats, maybe more than you're comfortable losing, it's time for step three, secure your stack. This sounds like a big step.
It is a big step, perhaps the most crucial one for true ownership. This is where you move your Bitcoin from those custodial wallets or exchanges where someone else holds the keys onto the main Bitcoin blockchain itself, where you control the private keys.
This is the not your keys, not your coins moment.
That's the mantra. You're taking direct possession. What you're actually holding on the blockchain are called UTXOs, unspent transaction outputs.
UTXOs.
Yeah, think of them like digital coins or notes of specific denominations locked to your wallet's address. To spend them, to unlock them, you absolutely need the corresponding private key.
And if you hold that key,
then you and only you can move those funds. No bank, no government, no exchange can stop you or take them from you without that key. That's the sovereignty part.
So practically, how do you make that move from, say, an exchange account to your own control?
You initiate a withdrawal. Instead of withdrawing to a bank account, you withdraw to a Bitcoin address generated by your own self-custodial wallet. Now, for any amount you'd consider significant savings, the strong recommendation is to use a hardware wallet.
Okay, those little devices.
Exactly. Devices like a Blockstream Jade or a CoinKite cold card or others. What they do is keep your private keys completely offline, isolated from your internet-connected computer or phone. This massively reduces the risk of your keys being stolen by malware, phishing attacks, things like that.
Makes sense. So you set up the hardware wallet.
Right. And during setup, you'll be given something called a seed phrase or recovery phrase, usually 12 or 24 random words.
This sounds important.
It is critically important. This seed phrase is essentially the master key to all the private keys your wallet will ever generate. If you lose your hardware device, you can restore your entire wallet and all your Bitcoin on a new device using just these words.
So you need to back it up securely.
Absolutely. Back it up offline, write it down on paper, maybe engrave it on metal for fire water resistance. Never, ever store it digitally. Not in email, not in the cloud, not in a password manager. Keep it secret, keep it safe, maybe in multiple secure locations. This step, securing that seed phrase, is truly the moment you graduate from just being a user to being a sovereign owner of your Bitcoin.
Wow. Okay. That's a significant level of personal responsibility.
Yeah.
Now, for people whose Bitcoin savings continue to grow, you mentioned that even a single hardware wallet might not be enough for, quote, world-class protection. That leads to step four, multi-signature or multi-sig security. What is that?
Right. So while a hardware wallet is a huge leap forward, it still represents a single point of failure. If that device and its backup seed phrase are somehow compromised or lost, your Bitcoin could be gone. Multi-sig eliminates this single point of failure.
How do they do that?
Multi-sig wallets require multiple keys to authorize a transaction before any Bitcoin can be spent. They follow what's called an M of N scheme.
M of N.
Yeah, meaning out of a total of N keys created for the wallet, you need at least M of those keys to sign off on any transaction.
Okay, can you give an example?
Sure. A very common and highly recommended setup is 2 of 3 multi-sig. You might create 3 keys, maybe using 3 separate hardware wallets. You might keep 1 key yourself at home, another maybe in a safe deposit box or a different secure location. And the third key, you could hold it too, or often it's held by a trusted third party, like a collaborative custody service, specifically for recovery or co-signing purposes.
So in a 2 of 3, you need 2 of those 3 keys to spend.
Exactly. This means if you lose one of your keys or one device breaks, you can still access your funds using the other 2 keys. Or if 1 key gets stolen, the thief still can't move your Bitcoin because they only have 1 key, not the required 2.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. It adds redundancy. What about other setups, like 3 of 5?
Yeah, 3 of 5 offers even more redundancy. You have 5 keys total, and you need any 3 of them to sign. This is great if you want to distribute keys across multiple devices, maybe different geographical locations, or even involve trusted family members or advisors for inheritance planning purposes. It allows you to really think about your threat model. What are you protecting against?
So with multiple keys, possibly in different places, how do you actually coordinate signing a transaction? You don't bring them all together, surely?
No, definitely not. That would defeat the purpose. You use something called PSBTs, partially signed Bitcoin transactions.
PSBT.
Think of it like a document that needs multiple signatures to be valid. You create the transaction on one device, sign it with that key, creating a PSBT. Then you securely transfer just that PSBT file, maybe via SD card or QR code, to the location of the next key, sign it with that key, and so on, until you have the required M signatures. Only then can the transaction be broadcast to the network.
Clever. So the keys never need to be in the same place at the same time. But setting this up sounds complex.
It can be. Definitely more involved than a single hardware wallet. But the good news is you don't necessarily have to figure it all out yourself. There are collaborative custody services designed specifically to help with this.
Like the ones holding the third key in the 2 of 3 example.
Exactly. Companies like Unchained Capital or Swan Bitcoin offer services where they guide you through setting up a multi-sig vault. They might securely store one of the keys for you, provide inheritance planning support, all while ensuring you always retain control by holding the majority of the keys needed to spend, like holding 2 out of 3 keys. It makes this world-class security much more accessible.
Okay, that's a really robust security model.
Yeah.
So we've gone from exposure to using to securing to multi-layer security. What's left? Step 5, build on Bitcoin. What does that mean?
This is where you shift from just being a holder to potentially being an active participant, an owner shaping the network. Remember, Bitcoin is open source. It's permissionless. Anyone can build on it. Anyone can use it. Holding Bitcoin inherently makes you a stakeholder.
So how can you contribute like an owner?
Well, if you're technically inclined or maybe entrepreneurial, the possibilities are wide open. You could consider running your own Bitcoin node.
Why run a node?
Running your own node gives you maximum independence and privacy. You're not trusting someone else's node to verify transactions for you. You're doing it yourself. It strengthens the network and gives you a much deeper connection to how it all works. Beyond that, you could actually build something.
Like an app or a service.
Yeah. Create a product. Integrate Bitcoin payments into your existing business. Maybe set up your own Lightning address service to plug into this growing global payment network.
Are there tools to help people burn things without starting completely from scratch?
Absolutely. The ecosystem is exploding with powerful, often open source tools. You've got things like Elenbits. It's like a modular toolkit for creating all sorts of lightning powered apps, point of sale systems, voucher generators, content paywalls, you name it.
Okay.
There's Albi, which is like a browser extension that connects you easily to Lightning and Nostr. And things like Nostr Wallet Connect, NWC, let other apps request payments from your Lightning wallet securely. These tools can power online stores, subscription services, ways to sell digital content, micro incentives. The sky's the limit, really.
That's exciting for developers. But what about people who aren't coders? Can they still contribute meaningfully?
Oh, absolutely. This isn't just for the techies. Bitcoin needs all sorts of contributions. You can help by simply using new apps and reporting bugs you find. Providing honest feedback to developers is invaluable.
Like user testing.
Exactly. You can support the builders financially by zapping them sats on Nostr or donating to their projects. You can join online or local Bitcoin communities, share your ideas, help educate newcomers, just amplify the signal about what Bitcoin offers.
So it's about engagement.
It really is. There's this philosophy emerging. We all own common equity in Bitcoin. Thinking like an owner means acting with a bit more intention, a bit more care. Whether you build cool tools, zap the builders, or simply use the network thoughtfully, you are actively shaping its future.
That ties everything together nicely. Okay, let's bring it back to the art of spent capital. We've clearly defined unspent capital, your secure Bitcoin savings, and spent capital, basically everything else. How should we think about spending with purpose in this framework?
Right. So the key idea with spent capital is its goal isn't necessarily to generate a direct financial return. Your unspent capital, your Bitcoin stack, is hopefully already doing that job by appreciating over the long term.
So spent capital isn't about making more Bitcoin?
Not directly, no. It's about using your resources, your time, your energy, your fiat, maybe even some sats deliberately. To acquire things you genuinely value, yes, but also fundamentally to help build the kind of world, the kind of ecosystem you actually want to live in.
And you mentioned earlier this fascinating idea that spending purposefully can actually strengthen your savings. How does that work?
It's this beautiful feedback loop.
Mm-hmm.
By consciously choosing to spend your money supporting people, projects, companies that are making Bitcoin more useful, more valuable, more accessible, more robust, your spending is directly contributing to the potential growth and success of the entire network.
Which in turn potentially increases the value of your unspent capital, your Bitcoin holdings.
Precisely. It's a truly symbiotic relationship. Your spending isn't just consumption. It can be a strategic investment in the ecosystem that underpins your savings.
Can you give some concrete examples of this kind of purposeful spending? Stuff that helps build the world you believe in beyond just buying more Bitcoin itself.
Sure, lots of ways. It could be buying merchandise like t-shirts, books, hats from Bitcoin companies or open source projects you support. It's a small thing, but it shows alignment and provides them some revenue.
Okay, merch counts. What else?
Buying tools that improve your own Bitcoin experience or security. Things like hardware wallets we talked about, maybe a kit to run your own node, subscriptions to privacy-enhancing services, or useful Bitcoin-related apps.
Investing in your own capabilities.
Exactly. Experiences count, too. Attending Bitcoin conferences, going to local meetups. You're investing in knowledge, community building, networking, all vital for the ecosystem.
And donations seem like a very direct way to support building.
Hugely important. You can directly fund specific ideas, products, or open source developers through platforms like Geyser, which is like Kickstarter for Bitcoin projects. We mentioned zapping creators on Nostr.
Right.
And supporting nonprofit public charities like OpenSats is incredibly impactful. They fund crucial work on free and open source Bitcoin projects, core development, education, research, the foundational stuff the whole ecosystem relies on.
What about more traditional looking investments?
Yeah, that fits too if it aligns. You could potentially support Bitcoin companies through equity crowdfunding platforms, maybe participate in digital security offerings built on Bitcoin side chains like Liquid via platforms like Sideswap, or even just investing in publicly traded companies that have made strategic moves into Bitcoin, holding it on their balance sheet or integrating it into their business like Block Inc. or miners like Iron or MicroStrategy, of course.
So lots of avenues for that spent capital to be deployed purposefully. Okay, let's try and synthesize this whole deep dive then. We're saying your total wealth viewed through this lens is really the sum of your unspent capital, your Bitcoin, and your spent capital, everything else you deploy, both ultimately measured. in Bitcoin.
That's the ultimate framework, yes. Your unspent capital is straightforward. It's the amount of sats you actually own and control. Securing it properly involves understanding that whole custody spectrum we discussed, from relying on third parties to hybrid models to full self-custody with single sig or multi-sig.
And weighing the trade-offs, privacy, control, convenience, responsibility.
Exactly. Always aiming to avoid those single points of failure where possible. Then there's your spent capital. Its value might fluctuate a lot when measured in Bitcoin terms, but its effectiveness comes from spending it without necessarily expecting a direct financial return to you.
It encourages more deliberate, maybe wiser choices about where that capital goes.
Hopefully, yes. And remember that strategic spending, the spending that supports and grows the Bitcoin ecosystem itself, directly feeds back into strengthening the value and utility of your unspent capital.
It's a really integrated view. So in a world that bombards us with financial noise and complex products, what this deep dive seems to show is that true financial sovereignty might go way beyond just accumulating assets.
I think so. It's about really understanding what your money is, how these different forms work, particularly Bitcoin versus fiat, and realizing how your conscious decisions, not just how you save, but how you choose to spend with intention, can actively shape the future you want.
Which leaves us with a final thought for you, the listener. How will you choose to use your unspent capital and your spent capital to build the world you want to inhabit?